Hello and welcome to the second episode of The Cocktail Conceit on the Rocks. Today we're going to be talking about the Scorpion King and also booze. My name is Adam. I am a cocktail bartender. I'm your host, and with me as always is my co-host.
My name is Logan Redden, and I am a craft cocktail bartender, and yeah, that's it. Usually I have an and. There's no and now. That's it.
No, that's fine. We don't need to put on airs. We're bartenders. We're mostly cocktail bartenders. We don't really have a whole lot of, between the two of us, we do not have a lot of experience in, like, beer and shot kind of bartending, do we?
I have a little bit, because I've done some, like, restaurant bartending, and,
Restaurant bartending, I've done some of that, too.
Yeah, the current place that I work at, I work some shifts downstairs, which is mostly, like, beer and, like, basic mixes. So, I've poured a decent amount of beer. I know a decent amount of craft beer, because I enjoy craft beer, so. But, not my expertise. Honestly, I would love, at some point in my life, to get to work at a brewery. That sounds fucking cool. Like, even just bartending on the front end or, you know, working in the brewery itself would be cool.
I think working at a brewery would be cool. I would actually really like to work at a distillery.
That'd be pretty cool, too.
That would be, not, to me, I believe, very interesting.
There's not a lot of really cool ones right near where I am. I would have to move somewhere else for that, I think.
So, do you want to hear an interesting, weird thing about Ohio?
Sure.
So, before the pandemic started, I was living in Ohio, and Ohio is a liquor control state. This means that every bottle of hard alcohol, anything that is 21% alcohol by volume or over, in Ohio is owned by the state of Ohio. It is bought in bulk, and any, like, hard booze is owned by Ohio, and you can buy it at liquor stores, but pretty much it's already been paid for by the government of Ohio. And what this means is that you can't get things that Ohio doesn't want to buy. So if they just didn't want to buy yellow chartreuse, you're shit out of luck.
Super.
So this really does limit the selection. There's a bunch of Amaros and other niche cocktail fun things that I like that were not accessible in Ohio, especially in Columbus, which is in the very center where I was living. One good thing about this is that the price of booze is standardized throughout the entire state, no matter where you go or what store. If you want to go buy a bottle of Plantation 3 Star, it is going to be that price everywhere.
That's pretty cool. I like that a lot, actually. Well, I like that for that reason, exactly, because yeah. I do feel like that's a thing I've noticed here in Indiana where, depending on what liquor store and depending what the item is, prices can just be dramatically different depending where you go.
Wildly.
Yeah.
A weird offshoot of that, though, is if you make your booze in Ohio, it's automatically legal to sell in Ohio. That state, out of all the ones I've been in, has the most craft distilleries I have ever seen. When I was living in Denver, there were craft breweries about every other block. Mm-hmm. But then just in Columbus, there are somewhere between 4 and 6 craft distilleries just in Columbus. That doesn't count Cleveland and Cincinnati. And
right. That's a lot of distilleries for one city.
It really is. And the stuff that they make, on average, is pretty good. It very much ranges from, hey, this is world class for a few of the bottles I found there, to this is okay vodka. It's too expensive for what it is, but it is vodka and it is okay.
I mean, I feel like that's a lot of vodka, honestly. Unless you're some fancy Polish European vodka that has been made for 200 years, it's probably more expensive than it's worth or what it's being sold
this
for.
This is true. But every single one of those distilleries had a vodka because it's the easiest thing to make if you have a distillery.
Yeah. There's no money work into it.
Yeah. They also all had a gin because that's the second most easy thing to make. You just take your vodka and put shit in it.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and they all of them had a fucking white dog.
Yeah. Well, if you're going to make a whiskey, then you're going to make a white dog by nature. So they probably just want to be able to sell something before their whiskey is full aged. So
that's exactly it. I mean, yeah. I understand the motivation. That didn't mean that any of them were good.
No. I've tried a lot of, I'm not going to throw any names out under the bus, but there's been one of the places I work for, has a lot of Indiana gin. They have like a bunch of gin that's all made in Indiana, and most of it's garbage, or just not very good. There is one in particular that has like a dirt kind of taste to it. It's like, I don't know what kind of botanicals they're going for, but it kind of just all culminates in tasting kind of like musky kinda dirt. Like dirt.
Well,
musky dirt.
I'm gonna have a question to ask you about it then. Mm-hmm. Are those gins made from White Dog, which is an unaged whiskey?
I don't know. It could be. I know all of those also make vodka, so I doubt it. I bet they started with the vodka rather than a White Dog. Most of them also make whiskeys, so it could be, but I doubt it's the whiskey.
I have seen a few places, like a few distilleries, that have made a gin out of their White Dog. Mm-hmm. They just take their distillate that's going to be whiskey, and instead they peel off a little bit and they're like, all right, let's just make this into some gin. It never fucking works. It is never a good idea. Hey, anyone out there listening, if you have a distillery and you're like, how can I make a little bit of quick cash before this whiskey ages for 4 years? Don't make a gin out of your White Dog.
It's a bad idea.
It's a bad idea. Just like put all of it in barrels.
I feel like I'd rather just have the White Dog, but I don't know. I don't know if I've tried a lot of gins that were made from White Dog, honestly.
At first when you said, I'm not going to name any names, I thought you were going to talk about unaged whiskeys that you've had, and I was just about to encourage you to very much name names, because it's not an insult if it's just true about everyone.
Right.
it's everyone has an asshole. Also, everyone has an unaged whiskey that doesn't taste good.
Yeah. I did try the Pabst, the PBR one, a while back. They have it's not really an unaged. Technically, it is aged. It's their, they age it for like less than 10 seconds or something. They like run it through a barrel.
I've seen some places do that too. So they can technically call it whiskey in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a funny gimmick. And honestly, like it wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be. It basically just tastes like a vodka, more or less.
You said it was from Pabst Blue Ribbon?
Yeah. Pabst made one.
They make beer, though.
Yeah.
When did they get into distilling?
That once, as far as I know.
That one time.
Yep. they could be making more. I mean, I would assume that if they're making whiskey in general, they're probably trying to make like an actual one, and that's just the first thing they could put out. And they play up the gimmick of aging
maybe
for 10 seconds.
4 or 5 years from now, there's going to be a actual PBR whiskey.
For sure. Although, I think one of the cool things about Pabst is they're not... I don't think they got bought out by any... Well, they're owned by one of the bigger companies, but they're not owned by Anheuser.
InBev.
Yeah, they're owned by Miller, I think. I want to say.
Miller Coors?
I think so. Or... I'm going to get that wrong. They're not owned by the big one. I know that.
There's Miller Coors, and then there's Anheuser-Busch.
Mm-hmm. Well, the big thing is that like a majority of your, even your off-label domestic beers are all owned by InBev now. Like,
give me some examples.
I'm going to blank on the exact ones, but I know that, like, I think Rolling Rock and a bunch of those, like, your like second tier domestic beers. A lot of them are owned by InBev as well.
I get what you're talking about now.
It's just one of those things where you think, oh, it's a cheap beer. It's probably just, you know, locally owned or, you know, not owned by anyone. No, they bought up like anyone that will sell to
everything.
Them,
anything, yeah. Anyone that makes a lager or a pilsner exclusively. Yeah, yeah. They just bought those up.
I think we talked about this like forever ago. But I found out that we talked about New Belgium, the brewing company in the United States, selling and being sold off, even though they used to be 100% employee owned.
That's a bummer.
Yeah, it is a bummer, but I did find out who they got sold to. Because I was Googling, I was talking to somebody, and I was like, I should really find out who they got sold to, because it would be a real bummer if they got bought by InBev. Because, you know, they've been buying up a bunch of those smaller distilleries for a while. But no, they got bought out by an Australian liquor company called Lion, I think. I want to say it's right.
Oh, I was not expecting that. Interesting.
Yeah, it's really weird. I couldn't get a lot of information on what else Lion owns. But they're like a big Australian beer and liquor conglomerate, basically.
Wait, Lion. Do you mean Lion Nathan?
Not sure. I think I pull up Lion was the... One second.
I have a vague recollection in my mind of Lion Nathan being the name of a liquor distribution company when I worked in New Zealand and Australia. And... since I have not lived in those places, I have not heard that name again.
One second. Yeah, just says Lion. I found an article from 2021. God, it's 2022. That's so weird.
I know. Ugh. I keep feeling as if I want to say, oh, it's 2021. Oh, it's late. Yep. No, it's 2022.
Lost a whole damn year. It's a Kirin subsidiary, is what it is.
Oh, so it's a Kirin. It's a
Yeah, because Lion is their Australian branch that's owned by Kirin.
Kirin, and Kirin is
Japanese whiskey, or not Japanese whiskey, Japanese beer. They make a there's a Kirin.
Kirin Ichiban.
Yeah, yeah, it's one of the most sold Japanese beers.
Yes, yes, it is. It is the shitty domestic of Japan. Yes. A secret for any of our listeners who haven't traveled abroad. Every country has its version of a shitty domestic lager or pilsner. In New Zealand, it's Spates.
I've had Spates before.
Yeah. Oh, you've had Spates before.
I've had Spates before. I forget where I had it, but I know what that bottle looks like, and I've had it.
Oh, that's so funny. Yeah, it tastes boring as fuck.
It's not good.
Yeah,
it's not good.
Yeah.
No, it's really not.
Again, I have a policy of not shitting on brands at any time. For example, if I go to a whiskey tasting and there's a whiskey that I don't particularly enjoy, I'm never going to say like, oh, this whiskey is bad, people shouldn't drink it. I'm most likely going to say, oh, I can see the elements in this whiskey and with the price point, I'm much more likely to criticize, a liquor or a brand based on the price instead of the liquid itself. That being said, just like with microdistilleries and White Dog, it is okay to shit on shitty domestics because that's the point. You can Spates doesn't taste good. Miller also shit. Budweiser not any better.
Nope. I will say of all of the U.S. domestics, Miller is probably the one I like the most, just because it is a pilsner.
I agree. Yeah,
it just has a little bit more flavor than the others.
Back in my college days, when I was drinking shitty domestics, as you do in college, Miller was the one I gravitated towards.
I feel like I would like Mick Ultra better if it was cheaper. Mick Ultra was about $3 cheaper per case. I would be like, okay, cool.
It's not cheap enough.
Yeah, it's not cheap enough for what it is. Like, I think it's. I will take a Mick Ultra over, like, if someone's offering me to, like, just for free, I'd be like, yeah, I'll take the Mick Ultra over, like, any other light beer, damn near, of the domestics. But if I'm paying for it, no, I'll go buy a 30 rack of, like, Pabst or something. Like, I'll go cheaper and it's the same quality and probably it'll have slightly more flavor. So.
I really do not understand Mick Ultra's ethos of, oh, we're beer, but we're a little bit low calorie.
They're not actually lower calorie than other light beers.
No shit, because it's beer. That's anathema to what beer is.
Well, beer is literally Miller Lite has fewer calories.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because beer is specifically meant to be high calorie bread replacement liquid.
Yep.
It was specifically designed to feed people who didn't have access to a lot of calories.
Right. Well, it's also, it was a way to save your calories too. So like if you had grain that you needed to use, you could use, make it into beer and it would last longer potentially. And also, you know, calories, and it gets you drunk. So there you go.
And it gets you drunk. So
probably
bonus.
Yeah.
But yeah, like trying to say, it's like, I have a metaphor kicking around in my head, but it's something to the effect of, hey, you want a low calorie beer? Like, yeah, I would also like a low calorie steak, but that's just not physically possible.
It's carb water. That's what beer is. It's just carbs and water.
Yeah.
And that's fine. You just have to accept that. It's like, I don't know, people that are like dieting and they always go for, like vodka sodas or whatever. I'm just like, well, you know, you can do that, but there's calories in that vodka because it just gets metabolized as sugar in your body. So you're just drinking sugar and like, you should just enjoy the thing you drink. I think we talked about this last time. I think we got on the same exact, you should enjoy the thing you drink. You should know how many calories are in it, probably. It actually bothers me that liquor companies aren't more transparent.
Required?
About. Yes, they should be required. Every beer, like some of them do now, we're getting to a point where a lot of beers and a lot of the seltzers are doing that too now, where they're telling you how many calories are in it. But I feel like liquor should just do that all the time. I don't know why it doesn't have a nutritional label like everything else does.
I guess because it is inherently poison, so a nutrition label would just have to say, don't drink this.
No, well, it doesn't need to do that, because we have lots of other shitty things that are bad for you that we put nutritional labels on. So
you know what? I just realized that water has a nutritional label.
It does.
And so liquor absolutely should too.
Well, I think the big reason is because it's regulated by somebody different. It's the, well, in the U.S., because it's the FDA that regulates alcohol, whereas all other food products are regulated by, I'm going to blank on it. It's a different organization. That's probably why.
FDA.
Oh, wait, no, it's the Food and Drug Administration. What am I talking about?
Food and Drug Administration, yeah.
Yeah. What?
And then there's an administration of cigarettes, alcohol, and tobacco, or tobacco, alcohol, and firearms?
Yeah, it's the ATF.
ATF, yeah.
Yeah. That's why. Yeah, it's regulated by something different.
Interesting point you just brought up is that there isn't a nutritional label on the back of booze in the U.S. that tells you how many calories are in the booze. Mm-hmm. I'm not in the U.S. right now. I'm in Taiwan, and sitting in front of me is a bottle of...
Four Roses. Nice. Bourbon.
Yeah, Four Roses bourbon. Made right in the U.S., right in Kentucky. And guess what's on the very back of the bottle?
Hey, is that a nutritional label?
Yeah, it's a nutritional label that tells you how many calories in 30 mils or 1 ounce of Four Roses vodka there is. A math equation. Why is there a math equation?
That's weird.
That is not helpful. Oh wait, it's 67 calories.
Oh yeah, see how easy that is. It's so easy. Literally, like that's all you need to put on there. Like you don't need to be like getting into how bad alcohol is for you, and or you know the negative effects of alcohol. Just like how many calories. I just want how many calories. Yeah, you know, because I don't know. It bothers me. It's annoying to me. Because it'd be really easy to do. Like, that's a tiny little label right on the back. You could change all of your labeling to fix that super easily. And we just don't. In the States, at least. Obviously, they do in other countries.
Yeah, which is clearly, good. Yes.
But now, the
reason I... Yeah?
If the United States decided to do it, it would just probably become the standard everywhere, all the time. Because then... anyone that was importing to the United States would also need to do it. So why would you not? You know?
That's a good point.
Yeah.
I was going to say the reason why I have this bottle of Four Roses is because of the drink I have today.
Oh, nice. Yeah, what are you drinking?
I'm drinking a whiskey sour that I put a twist on by throwing in some bitters.
That's a good twist to add on. So, just a little bit on top usually is good.
Standard whiskey sour, I used 3/4 an ounce of lemon juice, about 3/4 an ounce of simple, maybe a little bit less, 2 ounces of this Four Roses bourbon, and a dash of Fee Brothers Black Walnut Bitters.
Those are good bitters. I like those bitters. Not too aggressive. They just have good flavor.
They are some of my favorite bitters. It takes a lot to impress me with a bitter.
Mm-hmm.
Because Angostura exists.
Yeah.
And if you're going to justify your existence as a bitter, you either have to be better than Angostura, which you mm-hmm. cannot do, mm-hmm. or you have to be different in a way that is useful outside of Angostura bitters.
Yeah, you have to do something interesting. You have to be yeah. creative and be different. Because I feel like the only other one that really stands has stood the test of time is like Peychaud's. That's definitely not better than Angostura bitters, but it's such a different kind of flavor that it, you know, I would never substitute one for the other. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah, that wouldn't yeah, make any I sense. Agree.
Like they belong in different cocktails. They have different.
That
flavor
being said,
profile.
The hierarchy of bitters is Angostura, mm-hmm. S tier.
Yep.
And then nothing else in S tier.
Mm-hmm.
And then huh. down in A tier is orange bitters and Peychaud's bitters.
What's your preferred brand of orange bitters?
Actually, yeah, my preferred brand of orange bitters is a super hipster one, and it's called Wrath, R-A-T-H.
Okay. Yeah.
And I've only ever found it at a store called Fresh Market, which in Evansville is the Whole Foods knockoff that we have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they're just really solid orange bitters. I like them more than the big two orange bitters, which is, again, Angostura orange bitters.
Mm-hmm.
But those are way too expensive.
And
Regan's orange bitters, yeah. which is the standard for bars in general, I think.
Yeah. The big one for craft bars in general is Regan's, and then Fee Brothers orange bitters. The big
one I've
heard of.
Fee Brothers orange bitters are not good.
I don't like them by themselves. The big thing I've heard of before is people taking, it's called Vegans. You do Fee Brothers and Regan's and you mix them together.
Oh, yeah, that'd be interesting.
You basically just split them. I do like Regan's a lot. Or Regan's? Regan's, not Regan's. Mm-hmm. Let's not bring Regan into it. Regan's bitters, yeah. I've had those before. I like those a lot just by themselves. The Fee Brothers, I think, leaves a little bit to be desired. But I could see a combination of the two being good. The Angostura orange, I think, is fine. I think I would.
Angostura orange is great. It's if somebody handed me a bottle of Angostura orange bitters for free, I'd be like,
yeah,
I would all right, be mad cool, about yeah, it. Dope. I'll use this.
Yeah, but I think if I'm comparing it to Regan's, I probably like Regan's better.
Yeah, and Regan's is just so much more cost effective than Angostura orange.
It's really not super expensive, which is cool.
Yeah.
Because I feel like your regular expression of Angostura is not too bad for the cost of it. I have a hard time getting the bigger bottles in any liquor stores here, which kind of sucks. I would buy just the biggest bottle of Angostura
yes.
I could possibly get.
Giant.
Just huge.
16-ounce bottle of Angostura bitters.
As big as I can get. Because, I mean, I get usually like the 4-ounce one. I've gotten a bigger one than that before. I think the 8.4 ounce
there one. There is a 4-ounce bottle, an 8-ounce bottle, and I believe a 16-ounce bottle.
Yeah, I've only seen the 16-ounce one in bars.
But yes, I'm pretty sure I have to get that wholesale.
Probably, or it's just a thing that most liquor stores don't carry because they would never sell it. As most people, most average, like, I mean, I bought a 4-ounce one last time. It's probably going to last me like 3 or 4 months, and I probably use it more than most people do. So,
I am really happy that Angostura made Angostura D'Amaro, which is just the flavor of their bitters as expressed in an Amaro.
Mm-hmm.
I think it is one of the cutest bottles because it has that hard yellow plastic cap just like their bitters. And it's still cool. 35% alcohol by volume, so it's quite useful. And it's like you just took Angostura bitters and made it drinkable.
Mm-hmm. Made it drinkable by itself. It's really good. Honestly, I need to go buy another bottle because I bought one last month and went through it in like 2 weeks.
And
the next time I buy them, I'm
so
probably going to buy
good.
A couple. It's really
good. Angostura bitters.
It's good because it's you can just do shots of it like you would like a lot of craft bartenders do of Amaros, but you can also just mix it into cocktails or if you want, honestly, put on a Big Rock. I bet it'd be great. Big Rock, Orange Expression.
It is. Yeah.
Sounds great to me. I don't know. I'm I've had a couple of my bartender friends that are poking fun at me because I love Angostura and Angostura di Amaro. Like, any place that has it, I'm going to end up getting shots of it.
You should. It's very good.
It's good. It's really tasty. It's just good. It's probably one of the best Amaros I've had. I actually tried, I was at a bar I don't usually go to here in town, and they had Maletti. Maletti has an Amaro. I forget what the exact, I think it's just Maletti's Amaro.
And it was actually, I'm pretty sure I've had that.
It was actually really good. I was a big fan.
Yeah.
It was kind of Angostura-esque. Like, it wasn't quite as all spicy is the best, because that's the best way to describe Angostura. The flavor profile of Angostura to me is like,
yes,
very
Angostura all is all spices.
Well, yeah, basically. No, but it is specifically the spice, all spice, is what I get the most out of it. It wasn't quite that heavy on that. It was a bit more mild, but it was definitely better than, say, your Fernets or your whatever else. Or even like an Alpine Amaro that I've had some Alpine Amaros before that are pretty good. But it wasn't like that piney. So
I have had Maletti Amaro. I just looked up a picture of it to make sure real quick. I had that a lot when I was working in Nashville.
Mm-hmm. It was good. It was the first time I'd had it. So
it's very solid.
Yeah. And I think Maletti usually isn't that expensive. So like, it's probably pretty cost effective, I'd imagine. You didn't ask me what I was drinking, Adam. I feel very left out.
Oh, I'm sorry, Logan. What are you drinking, buddy?
Something I threw together because I ran out of vermouth. I have a bottle of Luxardo Bitter Bianco, and then I have a bottle of...
speaking of bitters, fuck, that is some good-ass bitters.
Yeah, Bitter Bianco is
and Amaro.
Good. Yeah, it's a good bitter Amaro. But I have a bottle of that. I have a bottle of Heyman's. I think it's Heyman's Navy
Heyman's
Strength
Gin. Heyman's is a gin brand. Oh, and you have the Navy Strength Gin.
I have the Navy Strength, yeah. And
which means... What exactly?
It's all right. Oh, it's very high proof. Yeah, it's like, I don't think there's a standard for it, but it's higher than normal. It's like the barrel proofing that bourbon does, more or less.
I'm pretty sure the standard for Navy Strength is 57%.
Is it exactly 57?
Okay. I think it's supposed to be exactly 57%. Supposedly, it is the proof, which is to say the alcohol by volume at which you can spill it on gunpowder, and the gunpowder would still ignite.
Interesting. Were they drinking that much gin next to their gunpowder? Does that happen a lot?
Oh, fuck, dude. have you not heard about... Yeah, in the English Navy in the, like, 16th, 17th, 18th century? Yeah, they were drinking that much gin next to
that's
their gunpowder. They were drinking that much gin next to everything.
Yeah, that's a fair point. They were drinking a lot. Because I know they did... For a while there, they had what do they call it? Your allocated amount of liquor that you could do per day, you got per day being in the Navy.
Yes,
yeah.
They did.
But I know they did that with rum for a long time, but that was later, I
rum,
imagine.
It used to be gin, and then they got slightly less xenophobic and allowed rum to replace the gin.
Mm-hmm. It was probably cheaper, too, to make.
Yeah.
I imagine. Anyway, the cocktail that I made. Equal parts Heyman's overproof, or not overproof, Navy Strength, and Luxardo Bitter Bianco. And then I did like 4 or 5 dashes of Angostura bitters just on a big rock, like kind of mellow out a little bit. I thought about stirring it, but nah. I just put on like a really, like a huge spherical cube. Just let it sit.
Oh, nice.
That's good, honestly. It's tasty. And I do have one other beverage that's not alcoholic that I'm going to...
Oh, yeah, rip it. Rip it.
Crack
just
open.
Crack it, lock it, pop it.
It's a LaCroix. I'm just drinking LaCroix.
Okay. I have also switched to my second beverage because I drank a lot of that whiskey sour while we were setting up.
Yeah, that's totally fair. Yeah, no, I didn't want to just sit here and drink only on that because that's going to be... It's really boozy. That's the reason why I let it like kind of water down, and I'm totally fine with it being mellowed out.
It is quite boozy. Speaking of quite boozy, the second drink I have tonight is... the last of this whiskey that is 54%, and it is a single malt whiskey aged in sherry oak casks.
Ooh, that sounds nice.
So this is from Cavalan Distillery, which is the whiskey distillery here in Taiwan. and it is really fucking good. I have worked at, I want to kind of gush about Cavland for a little bit, if you would indulge me.
Have at it.
I have worked at a Scotch bar in New Zealand. I've worked at multiple American whiskey specific bars in the US, and I've worked at a Japanese specific whiskey bar. So I have had a lot of whiskey. I'm throwing down my bona fides to say that if there's anything I would say like I am an expert at, I am a whiskey expert. I am okay with touting my horn just enough with that. And Cavalan, I would absolutely rate as competitive like on the world scene. This shit is really good. I like it a lot better than I do a bunch of... it's a single malt, so it's sort of trying to compete in that Scotch realm. And I like it a lot more than I enjoy most Speyside Scotches, which is the most popular form of Scotch. Speyside is the region where all the glens come from, mostly, like Glenlivet, Glenfiddich, all those very big popular brands. And this is just really solid. I don't think it's S tier or something like that. It's not my favorite whiskey in the world, but I would rather drink a bottle of Cavalan than most Speyside or Highland or even kind of most lowland Scotch whiskeys.
Yeah, I think generally I like some Speysides that I've had, but it's not my favorite. I usually like the Highlands because was it McKellen? McKellen is a Highland, is that correct? I want to say that it is.
I think so.
I could be mistaken. But I really like McKellen is probably my it's not my favorite, but it's probably my standard of scotches that I've had that I enjoy the most. That aren't because there are some Islas that I really like a lot. Lagavulin. Lagavulin's probably one of my other top tier ones. Personally.
It's really Lagavulin, good. Lagavulin is peated, which means it is smoked with peat, so the malt that they use the germination process. I keep trying to describe it, and I keep thinking, oh, wait, no, I need to go two steps back. Oh, wait, no, I need to go two steps back from that. I know too much and to the point where I'm not that useful. Anyway, it's one of them smoky scotches, and it comes from an island called Isla off the coast of Scotland. It's similar to Lagavulin, is similar to Lechig, Lefroig, Brookladdie. That's the one. And my favorite Scotch distillery, Kilhoman.
Kilhoman's good. I do like Kilhoman. I think I'm wrong. I think McKellen is indeed a Speyside.
Oh, that's okay. Really, you really cannot tell anything about a whiskey, specifically a Scotch, by just where it comes from. It
doesn't make a huge difference. The biggest one is the Islas. The Islas have a different process, so they specifically taste different. Like,
not even necessarily. They're just well known for peating their Scotch. That, but there's a Irish whiskey that I really like that is peated, Connemara, and it is a peated Irish whiskey.
That's interesting.
So yeah, it's super interesting. And there are also a bunch of other Scotches that are peated that don't come from Islay. They're just that's kind of like their shtick, but they don't always do that.
Because it doesn't need to be peated to be an Islay. It just needs to be from that region.
Just needs to be made on the island. Yeah. And I think there are 7 distilleries on the island.
Makes sense.
But even one of the big ones, Brookladdie, their flagship Scotch, at least the one I've seen the most of, it's in that baby blue bottle, and it's called Classic Laddie. It's not actually a peated whiskey.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Is it just a basic expression that's not peated? I mean, that makes sense. That's what I would do if I had an Islay distillery brand. I would for sure have a basic expression that was not beaded or very lightly beaded. Because, I mean, we can... the first peated I ever had, the first isle I ever had, was Laphroaig, and that is just the most aggressively peated anything I've ever had in my entire life. And I've met several people who love it, and I'm like, I don't... Like, it's...
Well, it's I've met several people who love Fernet. I've met several people who love Campari on its own, and I'm like, all right, that's okay, but...
Like what you but also gross.
Like, look, I'm not here to kink shame, but stop it.
Exactly.
If anyone we have here is listening from North America, Laphroaig is probably what they think of when they think of scotch or smoky scotch. And that's kind of a bummer. Laphroaig is definitely the most sold Islay scotch. But I also think it is one of the least welcoming. It's one of the least approachable Islay scotches, which is just a bummer.
Punches you in the usually, face with Pete, is what it does.
Yeah, it's usually the ambassador, and it's probably the worst one out of all of them you could have picked to be an ambassador, because it really just is not approachable. There is so much nice... Like, smoke is good. We like smoke. Smoky barbecue, that's a good thing. Campfire smoke smells great, has like good connotations. Smoke is an enjoyable flavor, but when you drink Laphroaig for the first time when you're 21, it is not enjoyable in that context.
I will say, though, I feel like the people that I have talked to who really like Laphroaig, that was their first scotch, and they really liked it, and they kept drinking it. And it's like, okay, cool. I mean, it weeded out anyone that wasn't going to like it no matter what. Like, it is I don't enjoy Laphroaig, but it is the epitome of what it's trying to do. You know what I mean? Like, it's all smoke, super peated. That's what you get. And
if you've got a nail, don't worry. Laphroaig's got a hammer.
Exactly.
That's all it's going
to
be.
It's there to do one thing. It's there to be really peaty and really smoky. And that's it.
That being said, I do enjoy it as a cocktail component. There are a lot of booze and liquors and different things that I really don't enjoy on their own, but when you use them as a component, they really come alive, and you really cannot replace them.
Yeah, that's how I feel about Fernet and Campari both. Like, I know people who like those individually or like them as specific ingredients or very like forward ingredients in their cocktails, but I think...
Yeah,
like an industry sour with Fernet, super good, super great, a good cocktail. But Fernet by itself, I don't like it. It's gross. It tastes like mouthwash.
Yeah, I agree. I do not like Fernet on its own. I like Bronca Menta on its own, which is
Still haven't tried that because everyone describes it to me as more minty Fernet. And I'm like, okay, that's the thing I don't like about it. So I don't want more of that.
You should really try Bronca Menta. I enjoy it quite a bit more. It's the Angostura D'Amaro to Fernet's Angostura Bitters. It is as if you took Fernet and made it drinkable on its own. that's what I see it as. I really like...
I mean, it is a lower ABV, right? It's like...
Yes.
It's down a couple percentage points.
Fernet on its own is 39% ABV, and Bronca Menta is 35% ABV.
Oh, I noticed something. This is tangent. I was talking...
We should rename the podcast that.
Alcohol Tangents? Yeah, yeah. No, I noticed something. We probably should. Well, it's the conceit. It is the conceit, Adam. No, I noticed something I was describing. I had some guests in the cocktail bar that I work in, and I was describing to them the liquors that I was putting in it. I kept saying ABV, and they didn't know what that meant. They were like, AB what now? And I was like, sorry. Alcohol by volume. And I had to like fully explain it to them because I don't know. I guess, you know, you get too deep in your own individual like nomenclature for your field and your jargon.
I've always heard that described as inside baseball.
Yeah. And I noticed a lot. We've talked about it on the cast before, but like Magic the Gathering or any card game.
Yes.
Same fucking deal. You get real, like, and it transfers. in card games, but like I can't think of another thing that the alcohol jargon will transfer to really at all. I mean, there's not really.
No, there is not.
No, there's not really. I mean, I guess, you know, no, let me take that back. I think if you're going from like liquor to beer, like brewing to distilling, there's a lot of jargon that carries over, you know.
Oh, yeah, I definitely agree. It's but I could also say someone saying, oh, that's still all just the same circus tent.
Yeah, I guess that's fair. I mean, I say the same, but I'm just thinking of, like, you know, going from playing Magic the Gathering to playing Hearthstone. Yu-Gi-Oh! To Magic the Gathering, there's, like, there's just certain terms that will carry over. Like, obviously, there's a lot of things that won't, but there's enough similarities that you can really carry over. Because there's I play a decent amount of Hearthstone still, and there's a lot of jargon that was carried over from Magic the Gathering. Mm-hmm. That when you think about it, it doesn't make any sense why you would call something a certain thing, but because that's what it was called in Magic the Gathering, it carries over.
Oh, nicknames for things like a bear.
Yeah, they don't really use bear much. Bear's not really used, but
things in that similar vein.
Well, usually it's like deck archetypes, so like burn or. Control. Yeah, control, they don't have unique names. Yeah, those are, well, I mean, those are pretty generic card game ones, but Burn, I think, is a pretty, you know, the premier direct damage face deck is Burn in Magic the Gathering, because it was a red deck that used fire-based stuff. And even though in Magic the Gathering, or in Hearthstone, most of the decks that do that aren't fire-based, they still call it Burn. It's still called Burn, because... It just makes sense, you know. It carries that over very well. That does make sense.
Well, I was going to say, part of like kind of the hidden conceit of season two is that we're taking a step back from talking about really, really specific media and getting really into the weeds about that, and just picking movies that The Rock is in, something extremely simple, so that instead we can pivot and focus a lot more on the alcohol and the booze and the inside baseball of bartending and things like that.
Exactly.
And I think we're trying really hard, but I still think we're definitely a little too high level, because we're jumping around, we're talking about bitters, and we're talking about Amaros. We're talking about a single malt whiskey. Maybe one day we should just sit down and have an episode of vocabulary terms.
Basics, yeah, maybe that's it. Wouldn't be a bad idea. I'm kind of into the. We'll see how far we get into the season, and we'll see where we go. We'll see where
we go. I do think our general premise of, hey, people, there's not a lot of inside baseball podcasts about booze and bartending from people with experience.
There's really not a lot of good ones. Well, my big thing, I'm not, like, once again, not going to name any names. I've tried to listen to a few different bartending podcasts, and it's either people that, like, and I think they've gotten better because I listened to a wide breadth of what they had, but people that started out really not knowing that much, and then it's their journey getting better at being bartending, or people that just aren't very charismatic, which sucks. Like, they definitely know what they're talking about, but, like, listening to them, it's like, I don't want to listen to you guys. And I mean...
Oh, wait. Shit. Do we need to be charismatic?
Ah, fuck.
I did not... Oh, shit. Oh, beans.
All right,
I did not put that into our calculations. Oh.
I'll have to wrap this up.
Well, this is probably going to be the last episode of season two, I guess.
Actually, it's very funny, because it ties into the movie that we're watching, or we watched for this. Yeah, no, and I don't want to toot our own horns, but I think we are generally both pretty charismatic guys that people would like to listen, talk about things, and enjoy the conversation that we'd have.
We're both like in our early 30s. We're both men. We're both straight. We're both white.
Hey, no, that's erasure. I am not straight. Fuck off.
Okay.
Well, I'm mostly straight.
We've got everything. We've ticked all the boxes, right?
Pretty close. Oh, we're also white. Yeah. We're also both white. So you got that.
Yeah, white. We've got these strong, general American Midwestern accents.
Look, those carry over very well. There's a reason why the CIA especially likes people with Midwestern accents.
Yes, yeah, I know. No, these are all like genuine things that are going for us. We have these very clear, melodious tones.
Yeah. We're not too Southern. We're not too Northerner. We're not too Western. It's really funny that we don't talk about accents as being Western, because there's not really a Western American accent.
There isn't. There just hasn't been enough time in isolation to develop that as its own dialect.
Yeah, I guess
or
so.
Or accent.
Yeah, there's definitely like East Coast people. Definitely. So, well, I mean, East Coast people sound different depending on what city you're in. So it's like.
Yeah. Well, fucking people in the UK sound different depending on what square foot you're in.
So what's weird about that? This is like a sub little hobby of mine, or like interest of mine, is different accent types. A lot of your British accents are actually not that old.
Yes, I know.
Like, they're only like 200 years old. It's super fucking weird that the regional differences that like we think like, oh, Scottish and English and, but even like not even just Scottish English, but like Cockney to other parts of England. It's all within the last like 2 to 150 years, like literally post, revolution.
Yes.
It's super fucking weird.
The revolution happened. I've heard that most scholars believe that this general American that we're speaking right now is pretty similar to how British people sounded.
It's closer, yeah.
Or at least closer.
Well, the weird
we're closer to how they sounded in, like, 300 years ago as compared to them now.
Yes, which is weird, wild to think about. Is you're thinking that you have this, like, idea, I guess from media mostly, of your, like, your British colonizers all having that very distinct proper English accent, and they almost definitely did not, and it's very funny.
I have a question for you.
What's up?
Do you think that you have become fascinated or interested in accents and people having different accents as sort of like a little tiny sub hobby or interest of yours, at least partially due to bartending?
No, I don't think so, actually. I think that's a separate. No? I think it comes from a very I'm going to tie it to, like, my early childhood, actually, because, so, we both grew up in Southern Indiana. I would say that I have a pretty basic Midwestern accent at this point. I have a few, like, catches that I think are very Southern Indiana-y, like Hoosier, but my mom's side of the family, if you listen to any of them talk, they have a very, not Southern accent, but very, I don't want to say hick, but it's that, it's hard to describe. You know what I'm talking about, right?
I do know what you're talking about, and I think we're narrow casting to the people who live in Southern Indiana.
Yeah, it's a weird thing where, like, Indiana is so far north, but there's a certain area where if you're in a small enough town in Southern Indiana, usually near the Kentucky border, and even, I met a lot of people from Kentucky that don't even do this, especially if you're closer to, like, Louisville or one of the bigger cities, but, like, there's that subsect of people who, it's not quite Southern, but it is definitely closer to that than it is a Midwestern accent. That's my mom's entire side of the family. Almost all to a T sound like that. And when I was very young, my dad, who had me for like partial custody, like heard me talking in that framework and was like, hey, like he was kind of, I won't say he was rude about it, but he was definitely like, hey, you need to not speak like that because if you do, people won't take you seriously. And I'm like, that was my first, and this, I was probably like under 10. Like I was probably like 8, 9 years old. And that was the first time in my life I'd been like, oh, you're right. People do talk differently and I should try to speak in a way that is more or less Southern or less hickish or less, or, you know, more, I should be more serious about the way that I speak.
Less distinct. More news anchor-esque.
Not just that, but, like, paying attention to the way that I am phrasing things and trying to not, you know, really enunciate and really speak better.
Like, so I definitely have the same story with my dad's side of the family. And my grandma on my mom's side, interestingly enough, they all have that Southern Indiana accent.
Yep.
And in our later life, my middle sister, Morgan, has really developed that, and she sounds very much like my dad now. But I specifically have not kept that accent because I went into theater when I was in high school and stuck with it throughout college. And so I have developed a very like newscastery type of tenor.
Yep.
It's so much to the point where when my partner Kat finally met my sisters and my dad and my mom, she was like, why don't you have an accent? They all have it.
Yep.
You don't, but they all of them do. You don't sound like you're from the same family. I'm like, yes, I know.
Yep. I had one of my partners in high school. She had heard my mom speak for the first time and was like, oh, your mom has a southern accent. It's so adorable. I love it. I'm like, yeah, that's a thing. But like, just the distinction that I don't and my mom definitely does, like, it's just it is a thing. It's a thing that's a thing. But it's super weird that it's in Indiana. But I've noticed this with people that are from northern Indiana too, that they have they pick up that like Wisconsin, like Michigan kind of,
the Fargo, what everyone thinks of as the thick Midwestern accent.
Yeah. It's a northern Midwest. If we're going to get really distinct, it's like a northern Midwestern accent. Wisconsin, yeah. Michigan, and like accent.
People who say sorry like they're from Canada.
Sorry. Yeah.
Sorry.
Sorry. Yeah, no, I've had a couple of like coworkers or friends who were originally from up in like in that region and who definitely have a little bit of that going on. And usually they kind of like downplay it a little bit. But the big one that fucks me up is people from that region call it pop instead of soda. They say pop.
Oh, yeah.
Specifically, they say pop. My mom and her family all say Coke for everything. Which is a southern thing, I found out.
Yes, it is.
But it's very funny that, like, I specifically say soda because I've done that since I was a kid. That I don't call everything Coke. I don't call it pop. Pop sounds super weird to me. I don't get it.
Pop does also sounds very weird to me.
I guess it makes it makes a noise, but pops.
Yeah. To tie this back into bartending, I actually had to stop doing that and became very aware that I needed to stop doing that when I moved overseas. And people would ask for soda, and especially in New Zealand, Australia, places like that, even here in Taiwan, if someone asks for soda, it is very specifically asking for club soda, soda water, unflavored carbonated water.
Seltzer, yeah.
Seltzer.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it took me so long to break out of calling any carbonated beverage soda.
Right.
And the only way I figured out how to do it was to call everything by specific brand names. And so I was... it's slightly awkward, but it's very informationally correct.
Right. All right, so we've been talking for almost an hour, and I feel like we should bring it in. We should reel it in.
We might want to start maybe talking
about the movie.
I'm
going to go back to a point I was going to make previously that I don't want to toot our own horns, but I do think that we're both generally very charismatic. And as I think this movie does not understand about Dwayne The Rock Johnson at all. It does not understand that he is easily one of the most charismatic actors that exists currently today.
Well, that makes sense because this is the first movie that Dwayne Johnson was the leading man for.
What movie is that, Adam?
Oh, The Scorpion King. A pseudo-sequel / spinoff from
prequel.
The Brendan Fraser Mummy series.
It's pretty... It's weird. It's written by the same guy. It's definitely envisioned. I think we talked about this during Mummy Returns, but it definitely... you can tell the studio just had the right... Or had the contract for The Rock already. And they're like, who can we put to branch off into a new series from this mummy thing? We've got The Rock. Let's put him in Mummy Returns last minute. We could use him as like a villain or some shit. And then we're going to spin him off into this whole fucking thing. And it's going to make a bunch of money. And man, they really dropped the ball on that. But also, I think the series has made money overall. Because I was
looking at the Wikipedia page. Series has definitely made money. They used the Scorpion King series after this as a testing ground for other lead male actors because it worked so well with The Rock. They thought, oh, holy shit, we had this Scorpion King movie and we threw The Rock in it and it took off like a rocket. Let's take let's take John Johnson, grizzled white actor of the week, and throw him in Scorpion 2 The Revengeance, and it's just gonna blow up. And they did that I think 3 or 4 times.
There's 5 of them, Adam.
Holy shit.
Yeah, I didn't realize that. And I was looking at the Wikipedia page. I looked up the Scorpion King series, and there's 5 films. The last one came out in 2018. Dude. Also, in 2020, there were talks of them rebooting it as a... Dude. Get this. A contemporary film set in modern day, somehow.
Huh?
I don't know. But The Rock is on to produce. I don't think he's on to be in it.
He's on to produce? Oh my god.
He's producing. And The Rock has more money than God right now, so he's probably one of the highest paid actors in the world.
Rock is so charismatic that the first leading man movie that was just a throwaway. WWE stars have had these other throwaway movies. Think of Stone Cold Steve Austin and the movie The Condemned. Think of John Cena. Like, we think of John Cena as kind of a movie star now, but he was in the original Marine and it went over like a lead balloon, and then he stayed in the WWE for about 10 more years and then tried the Hollywood thing again, and this time it took.
So I was watching an interview with John Cena. It was right after Peacemaker. It was like right around when Peacemaker came out. And they were asking him about the first film that he was in. It was The Marine. Yes. That was supposed to be Stone Cold Steve Austin. And
I see.
Yeah. And he had an injury around the same time, a pretty serious injury. It's probably, I think he stopped wrestling for a while, didn't he?
Oh, well, I mean, he stopped wrestling multiple times because that man doesn't have knees.
Yeah. But anyway,
his knees don't exist.
It was right around the time it was supposed to be Stone Cold Steve Austin. He had some kind of pretty, not like severe, but like pretty intensive injury, and he had to bow out. And what they did instead was throw John Cena, who was like an up and coming star. It was really interesting listening to John Cena talk about it because it was like, yeah, like I just wasn't, I was so new and I didn't realize the opportunity that I was being given and what was really happening, because like he had never been in really any film before. He'd only really been like a wrestler, which is a totally, like, I mean, obviously those skills can transfer over, but
it's both a form of acting, totally, but it's as if someone who is a Broadway performer was suddenly asked to play in the next Tom Cruise action flick.
Right.
Instead, it's because Tom Cruise's knees exploded. They would not be able... They would not be able to do it. It's two very different forms of acting.
Mm-hmm. Big truth. But anyway, it was really interesting hearing him talk about it as like an experience that he had where he was like initially like super overwhelmed and like was like, oh man, maybe I'm not cut out for film acting at all because it went so poorly for him. Like his experience of it was just not that good. And obviously the movie didn't go over very well, as opposed to this one, which actually I'm looking at the box office budget comparison, and it made 3 times the money they put into it, which makes it a commercial success, which is wild.
Yeah, that's a solid
terrible
movie.
This movie is so bad.
It is pretty bad.
It's so bad.
Okay, hold on. We are looking at it with modern tinted glasses.
No.
It didn't it come out in 2001?
2002. So 2002. But this... Okay, here's my thing. We've talked about this. We've yet to be able to do the original Mummy on the podcast because we didn't pick it for our thing, and The Rock is not in it, so we can't do it yet.
And we've already agreed that season 3 is going to be the cocktail conceit on the Frasier.
Yes, that is a factual thing. But... The first Mummy movie is legitimately very, very good to this day. because it is a fun action romp that is well written. The characters are fun. All the actors are charismatic and work. It's a good movie. It's a very good movie.
You have swayed me, because as soon as you said that, I did realize, oh yeah, The Mummy, a good movie, came out a couple years before this. And you know what else came out a couple years before this? Jurassic Park. And you know what came out a few years before that? Jaws and Aliens and both Terminator movies. Pretty much, you know, 8 of my top 10 movies of all time came out before The Scorpion King.
Right.
So they have no excuse.
Here's the other thing, and we talked about this. I mean, put a hat on it. This is the second time we've recorded about this. The last time we talked about one of the big actors, one of the actors that we both recognized in this movie, and we were super surprised to see him in it, because he's also
Theoden
Lord
King
of the fucking Rings.
It's Theoden King is in this movie.
Theoden King plays a bit part in this movie, and honestly, he's probably one of the better parts in this movie. Even though he has like 3 scenes, maybe.
Yes.
But it's super wild to see him in this, because at the same, so when this would have been filming, would have been right before Lord of the Rings was coming out. It would have been like right around the same time. So I guarantee you, Theoden King was filming this right on the back of having filmed his parts in Lord of the Rings, Two Towers.
Oh, yeah.
Return of the King.
He was in Lord of the Rings, acted up a storm.
Yeah.
And then Lord of the Rings hadn't come out yet, and he was still an actor who needed a job, so he played a bit role in a bit movie, and then Lord of the Rings came out, and he made enough money to fucking retire, I'm pretty sure, because I've
probably
never seen him in anything else.
I think we looked up his filmography after this.
Yeah,
we
did he was in some other things, but you can just stop. You were Theoden King. You made enough money, I'm sure. Don't do anything else.
But my point is, comparing the idea of... So I think the biggest issue this movie has is that this is before Lord of the Rings set the standard for what fantasy films could be.
Like, oh, it's a really good point.
Like, not... you know, obviously you have fantasy, like modern day fantasy, like contemporary fantasy, usually called like low fantasy. A lot of films have been really good at that for a long time. But, like, The Mummy is more contemporary than it is, you know... Well, it's more of, like, a period piece.
Yeah, it's kind of like action-adventure.
It's set in
the
a
The Mummy...
Time,
you know. Indiana Jones had already come out. People knew how fun and good and high-quality a pulp fiction movie could be. And so The Mummy was leading off of that.
Yeah.
The Scorpion King is... straight up fantasy.
It is
D&D ass shit.
It's super D&D. It bothers me though, because they keep trying to reference like actual historical stuff, but none of it makes any sense. Like, I would love for a historian, like an actual historian who knows this time and place that this movie is supposed to be in, to try to figure out when the fuck this movie is supposed to be.
Yes.
Because they have no idea. They're so out of their depth.
It is set in cartoon Egypt.
Yes, it's cartoon Egypt. That's exactly what it is. And it bothers me a lot.
I was just thinking, before Lord of the Rings came out, what would have been the touchstone for D&D-esque fantasy movies? And it probably would have been The Labyrinth.
Yeah, The Labyrinth's
that would
a
have been
one.
That would have be the thing that had set the bar for fantasy Hollywood movies, and so that's what Scorpion King probably saw itself competing against.
There's got to be another fantasy action movie.
Not one that got big. Like,
no,
there were other fantasy action movies. I don't know, Willow, but
yeah, Willow's a good one actually.
But that did not crest over Labyrinth. So Labyrinth was pretty much it until
Princess
Lord of
Bride.
The Rings. Princess Bride also still, it is known as
a
cult classic.
It's
a cult
movie, yeah, you're right. But didn't do very well. Yeah, I think you're right. Like, as a blockbuster, fantasy action movies just weren't a thing yet.
Until Lord of the Rings. Unfortunately, this movie came out at the exact wrong time, because they had filmed all of the Lord of the Rings back-to-back, which meant they had a very long editing process. And they filmed and put this movie out in the middle of the Lord of the Rings trilogy coming out. And but I would say
it seems like it worked out for them.
Did work out for them.
I would bet to you that one of the reasons this movie made as much money as it did is because A, there was a lot of goodwill still left over from the first Mummy movie, even though Mummy Returns kind of ruins it. But the Mummy Returns made money too, so like it's there's this idea. I forget where I heard this initially, but the next film or the next sequel in your series will do as well as the previous iteration was thought of. So like,
yes, I've heard that as too.
The prequel to your sequel did really well. The next film will do really well, usually. And it,
even
I
if
think
it's
I heard
bad,
it, yes.
And then, I heard but this, if that one is bad, if the next thing that comes out is good, it's going to reap what the bad one sowed before it.
Right. And I heard this, I think, the first time in conjunction with the Star Wars films, the newer one, the sequel trilogies, that one of the reasons why Han Solo didn't do as well as the previous ones is because there was so much backlash from The Last Jedi. Like, even though The Last Jedi did very well, it did well because the previous two Star Wars movies did well, so everyone was going to go see it. But Han Solo dipped because there was all of that weird backlash about Last Jedi, even though I think it's probably better than most of them.
I first heard this concept in relation to the Call of Duty video game series.
Ooh, yeah, that's a good example, too. Yeah, video games are another one of the big ones, is that, like,
because video games, unlike a lot of other media, are very sequel-prone.
Oh, super sequel-prone. Like, it's a problem, actually. It's like a running joke in a lot of video critic and video review circles that the market is basically just a bunch of sequels. It's returning. Like, you think films are, you think the Marvel stuff is bad? No, in video games it's been worse. I mean, at least there's multiple production companies doing things, but it's like literally everything's a sequel. Like, any of your big AAA things, probably a sequel.
Okay, so I have this thought that's coalesced in my mind about this movie, is that they bumblefucked their way into a hit.
Yeah.
Whoever the producer or the powers that be were on this movie, they were in the right place at the right time with the right people in so many ways. They had Dwayne The Rock Johnson. Nobody knew that dude was just a charisma machine. Well, okay, I won't say nobody knew. There were millions of people who knew that Dwayne The Rock Johnson was a charisma machine. Mm-hmm. They were wrestling fans. But no one took those seriously because at the time, the 90s and early 2000s, that was a very insular entertainment branch that was, for all intents and purposes, a monopoly of the WWE company. Mm. So if you were in it, you were in it. And if you were not, you were not. And so the only people who knew that Dwayne Johnson was a train that ran on charisma were those people. So they, lucky for them, they got him. Two, Brendan Fraser was also a train that ran on charisma, and they decided to put a secret pilot for this movie in Brendan Fraser's last movie.
Yep.
Three, Lord of the Rings, no one could have saw that coming thing happened and made fantasy way bigger. And so all these things just kind of coalesced and made this movie into a huge hit, which it should not have been. Really should not have been.
This movie should have bombed.
It was a pro wrestler as the star. No, that's not good. It was like untethered fantasy goofy shit.
Right.
It's not actually set in Egypt. I don't think they actually say the words Egypt at all.
No, they don't. They mention...
Also, this is another reason why I think it should have failed in the early 2000s, but a reason why I personally love it so much. The cast is super diverse. It is like the Fast and Furious series 10 years before that shit happened.
Right. And I mean, honestly, like a leading man not being a white guy, pretty big for the early 2000s, I will say that.
Leading man, leading woman. The closest thing to a white lead that we have is the main villain.
Yeah.
But the leading man, the leading lady, the sidekick, the like, and oh, like the, yeah, the Lancer, like so many of the actors who are also extras and are painted as heroes are people of color.
Yeah. And, which is pretty cool, and would be and cool a, if the a, movie took and a any division time of
to yeah, that. And this movie did fucking well, and no one learned that lesson.
Nope, sure did. Like, yeah, that's the big thing. Well, I don't know. It's and the biggest things with this movie that I think are problems are like just it the writing. The writing is so bad. Like yeah, the plot really structure bad. Of this movie is awful. And then also, like, the even scene to scene, this movie makes goddamn no sense almost at all. You can tell there's definitely, like, a few, like, set pieces they had in mind when they were making this movie. They're like, oh, we got to do this, 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 and this. And then they just kind of filled in the gaps. I don't know. It's super weird to me, and it's, like, I could go into, like, fine nitpicky stuff about every damn near every part of this movie. Like, that whole beginning intro scene feels like it's from a different fucking movie.
Oh, it is. It absolutely is. It's very obvious that the intro scene was filmed after all the other parts of the movie. It was they bringing back the actors for reshoots.
Right.
Is what that intro scene was.
Absolutely. Because it feels like it's filmed differently, too. Like, guarantee you the cinematographer was not the one who did the rest of the film was not there for that day.
No, absolutely not.
Yeah,
that opening different. Scene is extremely strange
and goofy. Like, it's weird because the rest of the movie can't decide if it's supposed to be serious or not. Like, it just keeps bouncing back and forth between goofy shit and whether it's supposed to be serious or not. And then, yeah, I think my biggest issue though is that they really just do not understand how to make The Rock charismatic in this movie. Because half the time he is just an asshole for no reason. And that's his character.
But he's still so charismatic. I think of this one scene where he falls into the sorceress's bath chamber.
Mm-hmm.
And he pulls out a sword and he jumps into the bath next to her, getting ready for a bunch of guys to run in. And she kind of cuts him with her little dagger on the elbow. And he just turns to her and goes... He looks at his arm that's cut, and he's like, ow. And like but he's The Rock.
Right.
He's so charismatic just standing there.
There's a few scenes where, like, they let him, like, be The Rock. And I can see it. Mm-hmm. I'm like, okay, that's cool. This would be good if, up until now in this movie, you weren't trying to be gruff, serious, no fun guy. And that's, like, it literally bounces between scene to scene, depending on who he's with. Like, if he's with the comic relief character... He's gruff, no nonsense, no fun
straight
guy.
Man.
Yeah. And then if he's not with him, it's like, oh, well, now I get to be goofy. And it's like, just do better. Just do better. Do better about what you're trying to do.
It's really hard to lay blame at any director's feet for saying, hey, you really didn't know how to use this white hot ball of magma called The Rock.
Yeah.
When it was his first film. And I think that's what you get to see in this movie is The Rock being charismatic and these shafts of light breaking through when he's being directed by somebody who doesn't know what they have on their hands.
Yeah, I think that's probably what was happening there. I think I would almost guarantee any bit where he was shining through a little bit was him doing improv or there being an improv moment. And then every other time, it was the director being like, okay, no, you're Matthias. You're going to be the Scorpion King, the villain of The Mummy Returns. Be serious.
Or just the director...
Be a dick.
...thinking, oh, I've got a pro wrestler here. This is
Be stoic and serious, and that's all you can be.
I think the director did this as a job.
Yeah,
and
probably.
And was like, hey, everybody, we're here. Let's do a job. It was a very workman-like process.
Oh, for sure.
That's why I'm very excited about the next movie that we're going to be watching, which is The Rundown.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they immediately in that movie, I haven't seen it for years, but in my mind, I remember The Rock being very charismatic throughout the whole movie.
And I've seen this one more recently. I'm excited to talk about it.
Well, before we get too ahead of ourselves and start talking about that, let's talk about what we're going to make this movie into, which is to say a drink.
Yep. Do you want to talk about what we did the first time? The first iteration?
I honestly don't remember.
I do remember this one, because I thought the name was very funny, and we made it as a club cocktail bill, which I really enjoy. It was the Flaming Yak Piss. Or I think it's called the Flaming Yak Piss.
Because that is the only direct reference to alcohol in this movie.
It is, yes. That was where we're going with that.
It is also the most viewed scene on YouTube. If you just Google scenes from The Scorpion King, it has the most views, which is the fire ants scene.
Man, that scene would be way better if it wasn't a bunch of CG garbage.
Whoever made this movie and the Mummy movies really has a fetish. Has a fetish for people being eaten to death by CGI bugs.
I thought that too. I thought that exact same thing.
It's a very specific fetish, but boy, did they have it and want to make movies about it.
So I just realized this. Do you know why that worked in the Mummy movie, but doesn't work in this at all?
Why?
Because all the CG scenes in the Mummy movie are shot in low light.
Yeah, shot in the dark, and the bugs are specifically black, and this one is shot in broad daylight, and the bugs are bright red.
Yep, and it looks just bad. It looks awful.
It looks bad.
Looks so bad. It's just, and you can see the actors like trying to interact with the CG. It's before that was really even a common skill that actors would have to have.
Yeah, because this is also when the prequel movies, the prequel Star Wars movies, are coming out, which really launched CG
into the stratosphere. Into the future. Yeah. The Scooby-Doo movies are wild to think about, that they came out like right in that time period. It's like, oh yeah, we'll just do Scooby CG the whole time.
Oh, no.
That was a great idea, wasn't it? I actually really like the Scooby-Doo movies, but they're bad. They're bad movies.
Anyway. We talked in a very different way about this movie than we did the first time, because we talked a lot more about booze than we talked about the movie.
We sure did.
So what do you think we should try to make this? I'm going to say the idea that I'm really drawn to. I'm really drawn to having a bunch of good stuff that we don't know is good, but is come together and is the reason why it's successful.
A bunch of good individual ingredients that don't come together to a good cocktail is what you're saying.
Well, no, it does come together.
I'm teasing. Here's what I would do. A bunch of individually good ingredients that you wouldn't think work well together. That's what I would say.
I want to throw out this challenge for us.
Okay.
No citrus.
No citrus. Okay.
No citrus.
So are we doing booze forward, or are we doing a shrub of some kind? So we totally do a shrub. That could meet your acidity requirements if you want to do something citrusy. Or not citrusy, but like take the place of
acidic.
Acidic, yeah.
I think we still have to do booze forward, because even if you have a shrub, it sort of ends up just being kind of like a Manhattan style thing.
Yeah. So we did the last time we did a club cocktail build. We could
stick with a club cocktail build,
but just not do citrus at all, because there's a few that I can think of that are, because what was the one that you what's the after dinner payback that you've had me try before?
That's exactly what was on my mind. The after dinner payback is a weird cocktail that fits this description pretty much perfectly.
What's in it? Go ahead and describe it.
All right, so it is four equal parts, generally 3/4 of an ounce. Mm-hmm. It is Laphroaig, super smoky Scotch whiskey that we talked about. Mm-hmm. So Laphroaig, Mezcal, which is a very smoky agave-based alcohol. It's sort of the peated whiskey of tequila. It's made the same way like tequila is made, but the thing that goes into making it is smoked. So it has a smoky taste. So
the way I like to describe mezcal is like the cousin of peated scotch and tequila.
Yeah.
Like if you marry those two ideas together, that's what it is basically.
So it has Laphroaig, Mezcal, Aperol, which is a nice, bright, bitter orange Amaro, and an Amaro called Sfumato. Sfumato is a very distinctive Amaro. It is dark. It is earthy. That is the best way to describe it. It is very earthy. It has this...
I like to describe it as tasting like dirt. It tastes like dirt.
It tastes like mulch.
It tastes like dirt.
Not necessarily dirt.
Not like if you took straight... Yeah, I think you're right. I think it's like a very moist dirt. Woody dirt.
Woody. It has that woody. And also, if you get a bottle of Sfumato, there is sediment in it. So
yes, you have to shake it before you pour it.
Yeah, it is...
I still have the bottle of Sfumato that you left me. I still have.
It's good. But you take all four of those very, very weird, aggressive, very distinctive flavors, specifically the Frog, this aggressive boot leather smoke, Mezcal, Aperol, and Sfumato, and you put them all together, and it makes a good cocktail somehow.
Mm-hmm. Somehow it works. Like, it just... Yeah. It's good. I don't like most of those ingredients. Well, no, that's not true. I like a good half of those ingredients. I think the Sfumato is interesting, for sure. I don't think I like it.
Yeah.
But Aperol and Mezcal are two of my favorite. Like, Aperol, I think, is damn near... You can't use it as a replacement for Campari, but I think a lot of cocktails that Campari is the main ingredient in, you could sub Aperol for, and the majority of people would like it better.
Yeah, it's the more approachable version of Campari, which makes sense because it is from the same house.
Oh, is it really? Is it made by the same people?
Yeah, yeah. Campari has four things. It has Campari, Aperol, Frangelico, and Chinar.
Oh, nice. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah, those are the four things that are made by the house of Campari.
Frangelico is interesting. I don't like Frangelico, but it's really...
Frangelico is...
It's really aggressive.
It's a nut liqueur. It's... walnut?
I think so. I think that's right. But the thing with Frangelico is that it's like, I've had a lot of nut liqueurs. Most people are familiar with Amaretto, is the most common nut liqueur.
Amaretto, which is an almond liqueur.
Yes. Frangelico has such a distinct flavor, and it's so sweet that
it is
anything you put Frangelico in, you got to be really cautious about how much you put in, because it's going to overpower. Yeah. You're going to taste the Frangelico.
Yeah.
You could put a quarter ounce of Frangelico in a cocktail, and I guarantee you I could taste it. It will stand out. And it's one of those weird... Anyway, yeah. And Chinar, I haven't had in a while, actually. I think next time I go to Mo's house, I'll probably have an awesome
Chinar. Is delicious. It is an artichoke liqueur.
Which is weird. It's a weird thing to make a liqueur out of.
It's great.
It's interesting. Anyway.
Okay. So, what... How... I want to maybe let's stick in that like after dinner payback kind of vein.
Yeah, I like the idea there. What are our components? So what we're doing four components based on this film. One is Dwayne the Rock Johnson.
Lightning in a bottle that no one knew was lightning.
What's a thing that no one really thought would be good, but it is good?
I kind of want to go somewhere around like Angostura, like bitter, something bitter.
Yeah, I was thinking, I don't know. I want to say I'm already Angostura, but my thing is, I think everyone who likes Angostura knew that was probably going to be good. Well, actually, no, that might work. That might actually work, because I think people who did like Angostura, i.e., people who did like The Rock when he was a wrestler,
knew that it was going to be good.
But everyone else is like, Angostura is making an Amaro? That's weird. No, it's not weird. It's perfect. Perfect idea.
All right, Amaro de Angostura. It's the rock of our drink. And it's literally the rock of our drink. So we should build it around that.
Yes. Okay, Amaro de Angostura. It's delicious. We were talking about it earlier, too, so that works out.
Yeah.
What else could we add to this?
What sort of base spirit would go well with this?
Yeah, I definitely think we need, like, a full liquor that's going to fit into this.
I want to say whiskey.
I could see that.
Mostly out of process of elimination. I don't think gin.
Mm-hmm.
If we put rum, it's going to get lost. And yeah, I think tequila would kind of clash.
Yeah, I could see... I could see some like weird variation on tequila, like mezcal working out, or like if we did some kind of aged tequila.
Okay. Marta Angostura whiskey, you were saying?
I feel like a mezcal could work. That is what I was thinking. Or like a variation on either tequila or whiskey. So like if we did like a peated whiskey.
I do like that. I was worried about being too close to that cocktail that we just discussed.
Yeah. But I think we've already got the Angostura D'Amaro as like a foundation. I think we can fit in a smoky kind of quality. And I think that kind of fits with this film. Because, I mean, yeah, it's like more Middle Eastern. And I feel like I wish I could think of a Middle Eastern liqueur or liquor off the top of my head that would fit. But I don't know any. I really just don't.
Yeah, it's not.
I feel like there's probably not a good history of that because the caliphate was always anti-alcohol, right? That was a thing.
Yeah. So even though they're the ones who discovered distilling, they did not use it for booze very much.
No, they sure didn't.
That's why you call alembic stills alembic stills.
Yeah, I will say this is like a weird tangential history thing. I actually really appreciate the caliphate for a lot of... Well, there's a lot of things they did not good, but there's a lot of things they did that if they hadn't done, we would be a solid, like, 100 years behind in everything that we have right now. It's ridiculous. It's actually ridiculous.
Well, barring that, we have Amaro D'Angostura. Amaro D'Angostura is not super high ABV.
No.
And it's pretty sweet. It is an Amaro, so there is a good amount of sugar content in it.
So that could fit our like sugar kind of component. So if we're looking at the Afternoon Payback as a format.
Yeah.
That might fit our Aperol-ish kind of level. Because that's the big thing. Aperol it's got alcohol content, but it's sweet. It's got a little bit of bitter. And it's got its flavor component.
I will say in that cocktail, Aperol takes a super seat in the back. It's still necessary because it glues everything together. Mm-hmm. But it's really there to lift up that smoky and that earthy flavor from the other two.
You need that sweetness to balance it out.
Why don't we flip that around and try to emphasize the Angostura flavor and have the other things accentuating its taste.
I do still think you need we need a full liqueur or liquor that's gonna fill out everything or to really
like the ABV
proof it up a little bit.
I think mezcal would work really well.
I think mezcal can work. I think a mezcal is the right call. Maybe not something that's the same thing with scotch, or like peated scotches. There is a variety in how smoky mezcals can be. The one we
something
have
like at, a Vita or a Banez, a good cocktail in mezcal.
Banez is probably the one. It's probably the one.
Banez, I think, is probably the best cocktail in mezcal.
That works well. Yeah, let's go with that, and then we'll fill out our other two ingredients, and we'll see where we fill after that.
How about, what if we don't fill out the other two ingredients? What if we throw in a vermouth and make it a Negroni kind of build?
Actually, that's interesting. I'm not mad about that. So we have Amaro D'Angostura, we have Mezcal. Which kind of vermouth?
What?
So we don't want the vermouth to overpower our Amaro D'Angostura is the big thing.
Yeah.
So I think we shouldn't go for... we've talked about this before, but... I'm gonna blank on the name. Antica formula. Yeah,
Antica.
That is super vanilla, super sweet, aggressive,
very distinctive
vermouth. Like, that's gonna stand up to anything. I think maybe that's not the one. I feel like we could probably go to like a.
Do we even want a sweet vermouth?
That's a good question. So I was gonna bring up Koki. So we could do Koki Torino if we want to do a sweet vermouth, or. If we wanted to go for something lighter, we could do like the Koki Americano.
Koki Americano. Yeah, which is a Blanc vermouth.
It is a Blanc vermouth, yeah.
It is a sweet white.
And it's got quinine in it, which could be really interesting in this cocktail.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think a dry vermouth would do well.
No, I don't think dry vermouth is the right call. I think a Blanc is actually probably the best call, because it's not going to be too sweet. Won't be too mellow.
What do you think of this, though? Blancs have a pretty distinctive flavor. I think a sweet vermouth, a red vermouth, has flavorings and botanicals and components that would harmonize and accentuate the Amaro de Angostura.
I think you're probably right.
But what if we put two dashes of Angostura bitters in as well?
I think it's going to be lost. I don't think you're going to get much out of it with the Amaro de Angostura being in there already.
Well, that's what I was thinking, is the Amaro de Angostura is already in there. I don't want to fully just switch that to Angostura bitters, like a whole ounce of Angostura bitters, like a Trinidad Sour or something.
What if you did the Amaro or the Angostura orange bitters? Throw in some orange bitters in there.
I think that'd be cool, but I also think that would end up... My idea with throwing in Angostura bitters was just as an insurance policy to make sure that Angostura bitters flavor profile is the thing that stands out. And
I have a feeling with
a sweet vermouth and an Amaro that is as sweet as Amaro de Angostura, the drink might start heading into that cloying kind of territory.
That's a fair point, yeah.
But if we have a mezcal, it's smoky and it's kind of drying.
I think that mezcal is going to help balance it out. I think that the big thing is, like, I think if we pick the Coqui Torino has like a it's a sweet vermouth, but it's not as sweet as some others, and it has that like dark chocolatey kind of flavor to it.
Yeah, and
I think the combination between those is, honestly, I would guarantee your Amaro de Angostura is sweeter than that Coqui Torino.
I could see that.
So I think the balance there will work. I can see why you'd be worried that the Amaro de Angostura is going to get lost. I don't think so. I think it's going to stand up. I think it's going to pair well with the smokiness from the mezcal, and it's going to pair well with the Coqui Torino. Those like dark chocolatey, dark fruit notes.
Yeah.
And it's really going to bring that forward. I think it will.
Okay, well, how about we say this? The build is Negroni style build, 1 ounce mezcal, 1 ounce sweet vermouth, Coqui Torino, and 1 ounce of Amaro de Angostura. And after we try that the first time, if we're like, a little too sweet, the Angostura is getting lost, then we can try throwing in 1 to 2 dashes of Angostura bitters.
I could see that. You think just stick with the orange peel garnish? I feel like that might be just good in general.
Yeah, I think so.
That nice orange peel expression. I'm gonna say I think if you threw some orange bitters in there, that might be good. But you're gonna have to get some that are gonna stand up well.
That's, you know what? Yeah, we could try to play around with that.
Yeah,
I think I would be interested to play around with that.
I think some kind of bitters is the right call though. But I'm questionable if you're gonna need the Angostura. Not that if you're going to need it, that if you add in Angostura bitters, it's really going to do much to bounce it up.
I could see that kind of being a hat on a hat.
Yeah. I think that Amaro de Angostura, I think you're not giving enough credit. I think that Amaro de Angostura is going to stand up pretty well to all the rest of those. I think it will. I think so. So some kind of bitters, TBD. Honestly, it could be whatever you decide to add. But yeah, if you think the Angostura is not popping out enough, Angostura bitters. If you want to try to accentuate the orange notes from your vermouth, maybe go for some orange bitters. And then you get an orange expression on there on top. That smoke quality is going to come out really nice. It's going to be good. I think so.
What would we call this drink?
That's a great question. So you described the rock as hot magma earlier.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's pretty accurate. He's like, this is him before he's been able to mold himself fully into what we know.
Yeah,
now
he's just this raw.
Dwayne
he's
the
just
Rock
this,
Johnson.
He's this lump of raw potential. He's like molten metal that hasn't been. He has a lot of heat and a lot of charisma, a lot of potential. Yeah.
No one knows. Molten rock or molten metal. That's not a bad name.
Molten Metal. Oh, is that a good name? Is that a good name for a Negroni style?
I like how the
the alliteration.
The alliteration is good. But does it describe the cocktail too? That sort of thing. Is like, does it fit the cocktail that we have? Because I feel like it's not. It's spicy. It's smoky.
It is. It's smoky.
And it's got that allspice, you know?
Hot.
I think molten. Hot. I like molten something. Molten.
Molten or melted or lava or. Hot light, or we could, lightning in a bottle. I did say also said
lightning
in a bottle.
In a bottle's not bad.
Lightning in a glass.
I feel like it doesn't describe the cocktail well enough, though.
That's my no.
I think that like rich. Some kind of melted or molten or magma describes.
Yeah, because it also brings forth like luxurious kind of like chocolatey kind of like melted chocolate is also like very luxurious. Melted. Hershey's Kiss.
Or, what about I was gonna say chocolate magma, but I feel like I don't want to go too hard on the chocolatey
because that's not really what's gonna be in there.
Yeah.
Magma.
Magma. Molten.
Molten rock.
Molten. Yeah, maybe. Molten rock. I mean, it's the rock.
It's the rock.
Yeah, I'm not mad about that, actually.
I kind of like that.
Yeah. Okay, it's got to have one big cube.
Oh, yeah, served on a big rock.
One big rock, yes, exactly. Yeah,
of course,
yeah,
Negroni presentation, yeah, molten rock.
Molten rock. I like that. Yeah, it's good, it's good. Okay, this is a thing for preparation. I have said this for a very long time. I don't know if this is standard... what most bartenders do when I do Negroni builds, I always stir it down first, always, because
how so, what do you mean?
I will mix it in a mixing glass with ice, stir it down, add some dilution, chill it, and then add it into my glass with a big rock, usually is what I will do. And I've been to a lot of bars before where they'll just build in glass, and I don't like that. I think it makes for a worse cocktail generally.
Why so?
Because I think the little bit of extra dilution actually helps mellow out all of your ingredients, especially with a base Negroni.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. I was thinking you build in glass and then you stir it down in the glass.
I think that works fine. I would rather have it already diluted, chilled, then added to ice and delivered, so it's both cold already. And it doesn't ruin. It doesn't like pull any dilution out of the ice that you already have in your glass. You know what I mean? So like, I want to add it cold to the glass so that the ideal temp is already there, the ideal dilution is already there,
and the huge big rocks in glasses are meant to. They're not meant to cool and chill. Mm-hmm. They are meant to maintain
and dilute slowly.
Yes,
over time, and that's my big thing. Is that I think. As long as you're doing big rocks, that's fine. If you don't have access to big rocks, then I could see building a Negroni
building
with small ice.
In the glass. Yeah. If you only have small ice, build it in the glass and stir it in the glass.
Yeah.
If you have big rocks, build it in your mixing glass, your Hori.
Yeah.
Stir it down. And then, I totally agree with that.
Order
of operations.
Especially with, my thing is like with a basic Negroni build with Campari. I also think Campari, if you don't do that, and you don't start down in the glass as is, that Campari is way too aggressive. It's going to be...
Yes.
Yeah. I've just been to bars before where they'll build in glass, and I know that they didn't stir it down at all. And I got the drink, like, kind of cold, and that Campari just, like, punches you in the face, like, immediately.
No. Like, it just doesn't... Any cocktail needs dilution. Even if you're serving it at room temperature, you need to add water to dilute it.
But the big thing I would compare it to is like the way you build like a Manhattan is that I think you should never build a Manhattan in glass. You should build a Manhattan in a mixing glass, stir it down.
Yeah.
And then even if you're pouring it on rocks, it should still be stirred down.
Yeah, I agree. So
it's the same kind of deal. You want that
I totally
dilution.
Agree.
It adds a lot to the cocktail.
Yeah. And most pretty much all modern booze and cocktail making ingredients are made to be diluted.
Yeah, with dilution in mind. And yeah, it just makes a huge, huge difference to me.
If you have the components for a classic Negroni, gin, Campari, sweet vermouth, just try this at home. Throw an ounce of gin, Campari, sweet vermouth into a glass, and then have a second glass with 1 ounce of gin, Campari, sweet vermouth, and then throw an ounce of room temperature water in. Mm-hmm. And I guarantee, even though they're both hot room temperature, you will like the one with water in it more.
With that water. Yeah, I would agree. Yeah. Okay, so final build is 1 ounce mezcal.
Final build.
1 ounce Coqui Torino, preferably. You could probably use a different sweet vermouth, but that would be... That's the flavor profile you probably want. That kind of balance between sweet and your chocolatey red fruit kind of flavors. Yeah. And then 1 ounce Amaro D'Angostura, orange peel expression. You could, as an addendum, add in like 2 to 3 dashes of some kind of bitters. Angostura if you think the Amaro's not keeping up, or orange bitters if you want to add in a little bit of something extra.
I like it. The Molten Rock.
Molten Rock. Cool. That actually sounds like a really good cocktail. Oh, yeah. You tried the one from last episode, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I tried the Scorpion Centaur. It is bad. It's not a good drink. Don't make that build.
Honestly, I forgot what the build was already.
I was too trepidatious that rye whiskey and green chartreuse would be too punchy, and I thought, hey, let's throw it on a big rock to calm it down. Let's put an egg white in it to stretch it out, dilute it, calm it down. And it calmed it down way too much, came out super thin and unflavorful. So
what do you think the solution would be to, because it was a club cocktail build, right?
No, it was a Daisy style build.
Oh, we did a Daisy. Right.
I would immediately throw out that egg white. And I think throwing out that egg white and getting a punchier rye instead of Rittenhouse, something like a Dickel or something with just a much higher rye content in the mash bill.
Right.
And just build it like a margarita, but with all the ingredients switched out.
Is Rittenhouse not 100% rye?
No. It's pretty good amount of corn in the mash bill.
Huh.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, I think I would agree. If you're, god damn it, I tried to Google Rittenhouse and the first thing that came up was Kyle Rittenhouse.
That's so upsetting. Oh, that sucks.
That's so upsetting.
Okay. We'll talk about that drink perhaps more once I try it again in a different style. Yeah,
give it another shot.
And honestly, maybe next episode we can try this drink, because this one actually sounds really fucking good.
Honestly, if I can get a bottle of Coqui Torino, I haven't been able to find it lately, which is unfortunate. I could make this at the bar I work at, like this weekend. So I might.
Well, hopefully next time you can report back on this drink.
Yeah.
All right.
It sounds great to me.
Well, it's good talking to you, Logan.
Yeah, it's good talking to you, Adam.
Next time we're going to be watching The Rundown.
The Rundown.
The Rundown.
Yeah, it's a movie.
It's a movie starring The Rock, which is the only criteria on season 2 of The Cocktail can see on the rocks. Thank you so much for listening to that episode. I had a lot of fun. Logan, did you have a lot of fun, Logan?
I had a really good time.
Yeah, it was a really good time. We got drunk. We talked about a thing. We made a cocktail.
That sure was a thing.
If you want to hear more about the cocktails that we're making, follow us on Instagram at Cocktail Conceit. We post more than just the cocktails on the show. We post cocktails that we're working on in our outside life. And if you want to ask us about media or cocktails or anything in between, contact us by emailing overlyhornybostonbusdriver@gmail.com. Logan, how do you spell that?
I'm not spelling that, Adam, but it is overlyhornybostonbusdriver@gmail.com. Pretty easy to figure out. And if you'd like to further support us, you can join us on Patreon, where you'll get access to exclusive content and cocktails made by yours truly. Thanks, guys.
Bye! Oh, hey, there's Toby.
It's Toby. There he is. He's got a spot. What do you know?